From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet novelist Philip Roth. His new novel is his second book that refers to a recent physical ordeal and severe depression. We'll talk about what really happened and about some of the themes that have recurred in his fiction since Goodbye Columbus and Portnoy's Complaint. Also today, is there a gay culture comparable to ethnic and racial cultures? We'll talk to Frank Browning about his new book, The Culture of Desire. And rock critic Kentucky reviews Mick Jagger's new solo album, Wandering Spirit. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A federal judge ruled today that the Health Reform Task Force, headed by Hillary Rodham Clinton, must hold its meetings in public. U.S. District Judge Royce Lamberth said that the task force is subject to open meetings laws in part because the First Lady is a private citizen. White House spokesman George Stephanopoulos said the ruling doesn't apply to the working sessions that the task force has held so far. He said the task force will have a public meeting and that appropriate notice will be given. The ruling came in a suit brought by two health care organizations and a public interest group, charging that it was illegal for the administration to exclude the public. President Clinton announced new regulations governing bank loans today, saying they'd result in new lending to small and medium-sized businesses. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton's new rules require no legislation. They're regulatory changes designed to ease the credit crunch and allow small businesses to borrow more easily. The four agencies that regulate banks and savings and loans are still working out the details, but in a joint statement released today, they promised that all the changes would be implemented within the next 3 months. Part of the program would encourage banks to make loans to small businesses on the basis of the borrower's character and reputation, not only on his financial condition. And certain appraisal requirements for real estate would be eased. Some consumer groups have questioned whether loosening banking regulations would lead to another SNL-type crisis. The president said today that no taxpayer money will be put at risk. It will be impossible to measure exactly how much money is freed up by the new regulations. One advisor to the administration said the effect would be marginal at best. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
An emergency session of the Russian Congress of People's Deputies opened in Moscow today, and opponents of President Boris Yeltsin have proposed measures that could end his authority to pursue economic reforms. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
The proposals by leaders of the Conservative Congress are designed to make the Russian presidency into a figurehead position and turn all governing power in Russia over to the parliament, still dominated by communists, who want to reverse Russia's move to a market economy. The proposals would cancel a nationwide referendum scheduled for next month, which Yeltsin had sought to strengthen his ability to govern Russia. They would strip the president of the power to name the ministers of his government, and they would bestow all power to initiate legislative programs on the parliament. The executive branch under these proposals would exist solely to carry out the will of the parliament. Yeltsin's opponents appear to have enough votes to adopt these measures. Yeltsin himself is expected to address the Congress tomorrow, but his supporters fear he may have little or no chance of blocking the Congress. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 6 points to close at a record 3,478. Advances led declines by a margin of 5-4. This is NPR News. The chairman of the Senate Budget Committee has offered a 5-year deficit trimming plan that contains $96 billion more in cuts than that proposed by President Clinton. The plan, proposed by Tennessee Democrat Jim Sasser, exceeds the House Budget Committee's proposed cuts by $33 billion. The Senate plan would impose heavier taxes on the wealthiest 10% of Americans, raising another $23 billion in taxes. The House version exceeds the Clinton plan by increasing cuts in spending. Congressional leaders have said they hope to complete work on the fiscal 1994 budget bill by early April. Secretary of State Warren Christopher announced today that Israel, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and the Palestinians have been invited to resume peace talks in Washington on April 20th. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Israel has already accepted the invitation, but the Palestinian delegation has not. insisting that Israel must first repatriate 400 Palestinian deportees and promise to deport no more. But Secretary Christopher expressed confidence that all the Arab delegations would attend the next round of talks.
My conviction continues to be that the Palestinians will want to return to the negotiations because they see in those negotiations and the United States' willingness to serve as a full partner an opportunity to make real progress.
All the parties are being asked to send representatives to Washington in late March or early April for consultations. In addition to the bilateral peace talks starting April 20th, multilateral Middle East talks on regional problems such as refugees and water are scheduled to resume on April 27th in Geneva. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The full Senate has scheduled a vote tomorrow on the nomination of Miami prosecutor Janet Reno as Attorney General. The Senate Judiciary Committee approved the nomination by a unanimous vote this afternoon. No senators are known to have objections to Reno's confirmation. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There was a time when Philip Roth was accused of being a Jewish anti-Semite for writing about Jewish middle-class life in a humorous and not always flattering way. His early books, Goodbye Columbus and Portnoy's Complaint, brought him early fame. He's now regarded as among our foremost writers. What it means to be Jewish is a theme that continues to preoccupy Roth in his new novel, Operation Shylock. Another of his favorite themes is in this novel, the line between truth and fiction. The main character is named Philip Roth. On a trip to Israel, he meets a man posing as Philip Roth, using the famous writer's name to get publicity for his cause. The plot is quite convoluted, and Roth would like readers to believe it is truth, not fiction. As improbable as that may be, at least some of what happens to the Philip Roth character happened to the real Roth. In the preface, Roth explains that a few years ago, after minor knee surgery, his pain kept getting worse. His doctor prescribed pills, and Roth's mind soon began to disintegrate.
This disintegration was induced by the sleeping pill called Halcyon.
Mm-hmm.
The book goes on from the little section you just referred to describe in length my discovery that I was having a drug-induced psychosis.
Was it the first time that you experienced that kind of mental and physical disintegration?
I've experienced nothing like it before in my life and nothing like it since. It was truly horrible. I believe many people will be familiar with William Styron's book, Darkness Visible.
Yeah.
And in which he describes his depression. Well, I don't know if all those readers of Darkness Visible will have seen Styron's piece in The Nation about 2 or 3 months ago about his experience with the same drug, Halcyon. And he now seems to feel, using that article in The Nation as by reference, that Halcyon played a very powerful part in bringing about his true catastrophe, which I must say was even worse than my own.
Did you think you were going crazy?
Yes,
at the time.
I thought I was crazy. I thought I had gone crazy. I didn't know why. It's so unlike anything, though I certainly made my best effort in the book, in Operation Shylock, in describing it. It's inappropriate for a writer to say that words can't describe it, since that's my job. But there's a measure of pain and disorientation that is truly unimaginable to me. By the way, even now, however many years later it is, it's unimaginable to me. All I know is I don't take any pills of any kind. I don't even take my aspirin any longer.
I want to talk with you a little bit more about ordeals, if that's okay. I'd like to refer back to your recent book, Patrimony, which was about the last period of your father's life before he died at the age of 88 from a brain tumor. And you took care of him near the end. And certainly the impression I got from the book is that as difficult an ordeal as that was for him to be sick and as difficult as it was for you to take care of him, that you were really glad to be able to be there for him and glad for the way that it changed the nature of your relationship.
Yes, I was fortunate, as one is fortunate, I think, to be alongside somebody very valuable and dear to you when they're experiencing dying. It goes without saying that you can furnish some comfort, if whatever comfort could come through to a dying person, and there is some. But in addition, to be present at the closing of a life that was important to you is important, very important. It was to me.
You went through, almost an epiphany while cleaning your father's feces on the bathroom floor when he was sick.
Yeah. Well, you know, I did what any, what they used to be called nurse's aide. I don't know what they're called now, but a nurse's aide does in a hospital for the ill. To be sure, it's something that most of us aren't accustomed to doing or trained to doing, unless we're tending small infants. And then, of course, we do deal with feces, urine, vomit, and so on and so on. But, of course, we're unused to doing this for each other as adults, unless it's something we do professionally, like a nurse or a doctor, some kind of a medical helper. And my father had come out of the hospital where he'd had a biopsy for this brain tumor. It was an innocuous procedure, they call it. But, you know, it had been pretty traumatic and trying for him. And he was battling, but he was tiring. And when he got to our house and was visiting with us, his bowel regularity had been thrown off by the hospital stay. And so he had what's politely called an accident. As he said it, I beshat myself. I thought it was a rather elegant formulation for a man in the midst of that travail, really. And I sort of found him in the bath. He was trying to deal with this himself. Well, it's like a child trying to deal with changing a diaper, an infant. It couldn't be done. And so I put him in the shower and helped him wash himself down, put him to bed. And then I came back and deal with this mess. Now, as I said in the book, I just assumed would have nailed the door shut to the bathroom and ruled that room off limits for the rest of our lives. I didn't want to do this any more than anybody else does. But it had to be done, and what the hell. So I went in there and used all the appropriate cleaning devices and did it, and was as, you know, gagged as everyone does, and was as nauseated as anybody else would be, and didn't much care for it. And yet, when it was over, I felt, yes, this is okay. That was all right. I don't want to belabor this because it can become maudlin. It didn't feel maudlin at the time. It felt like a powerful experience. And that it seemed to me there was a certain rightness in the task I had been called upon to perform.
When your father died, I don't know how observant you are as a Jew, but when your father died, did you sit shiva?
No.
For our listeners who might know, shiva is the mourning period and the way of sitting in mourning in the Jewish religion. Did you go through a crisis about whether to do it out of respect for him or whether he would have wanted you to do it and so on and so on?
No. I'm not connected to institutional Judaism, and I have my own private institutions.
Mm-hmm. How observant was your father?
Well, he was rather typical, I think, of men of his generation. My father was born in 1901. He was very skimpily educated. He just went through grade school and then went off when he was 13 years old to work in a factory and worked all his life. He was not learned in anything particularly except in life, which is okay. But he was not a student of a Jewish religion or rituals or customs. His father had been trained as a rabbi, though he didn't work as one, and so he knew all the stuff, but he was a deeply secularized Jew. His connection to Jews was profound, passionate, all-pervasive, but his connection to institutional Judaism or the institutions of the religion was, wasn't marginal as much as it was conventional, you know?
Yeah.
He went to the synagogue and so on. But he enjoyed the synagogue because of the people he saw there and the social opportunity it provided to be among like-minded people, more for that than for prayer and communion with God. But, you know, how do I know what kind of community
right,
he had there?
Right, right.
So I say that and then I withdraw it halfway.
Right. Philip Roth is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Philip Roth. He has a new novel called Operation Shylock, A Confession. Before you started writing about Jewish life, Jewish culture, did you think that your life, your kind of life, could be the subject of fiction?
No. I think one of the discoveries that a young writer makes is just this thing you're pointing to. It's a key discovery, and that is that my little place here, this X Street and Y Street and Z Street, that this place is as much the stuff of fiction as anything else. Strange that it should be so difficult to make this discovery. But what happens, of course, is for people like me who discover books in college, you read what's called literature with an L, you read the great writers, and you somehow can't associate, stupidly, by the way, or let's just naively or youthfully, you can't associate your little place, whether it's called Newark or Akron or Dayton or Louisville or whatever, and Joyce's Dublin, because it's Joyce. That's what gets in your way. But if you go back and just think, he wrote a book called Dubliners, why can't I write a book called Newarkers?
So what made you realize that you could write about your area of the world?
I think that I just got a little smarter in my early 20s, abandoned the derivative kind of short stories that I, and I think most budding writers write, and realized that this place that I'd come out of and that interested me, I would put it this way, that this had been given to me.
You know, Zuckerman, at the end of your book, The Facts, the Zuckerman character who's commenting on the memoir that Philip Roth has written says, look, this place you come from does not produce artists so much as it produces dentists and accountants.
Well, he's right on the right on the money, right on the money there. My four closest friends all became doctors.
Uh-huh.
So it seems to produce doctors in a proportion of 4-1 over writers.
Did you feel like it would be extra special hard for you to become a writer because the place that you're from is more likely to produce accountants and dentists?
Well, as my greatly gifted colleague Saul Bellow says, that boys like us have to anoint themselves. I mean, you've got to pour the oil over your own head, you know. But I was helped. I had no models in the neighborhood, that was for sure. But once you begin to discover books, the idea, if you're a bookish young fellow, an ambitious young fellow, the idea becomes less strange to you.
Early in your career, you became known for writing about Jewish life from a kind of ironic perspective. You're still writing about a lot of Jewish themes. What keeps you writing about that? And, you know, I'll mention parenthetically that it's not the faith, obviously, because you don't really practice.
Mm-hmm. But then, as we know, that Jewish life is considerably more than the faith.
Yes.
Or let's put it another way, the predicament of Jews is of interest to me.
Uh-huh.
If we drop the word life in this context, we can make it clearer to the audience that the historical predicament of Jews right down to whatever day this is in 1993 is not only of interest to me, but I have an instinctive, I think, understanding or feel for it. But to retrace the question you asked, let's go back to the example I gave of Joyce. I'm using Joyce, the greatest master of 20th century prose, not because I consider myself to be his equal as a writer. I'm using him as a convenient example that everybody knows. What kept Joyce writing about Dublin all his life? He was a man who fled Ireland when he was a young man, hated it, by the way, loathed it, and lived his life as a kind of rootless cosmopolite, the Nazi tag for Jews. But Joyce lived as a kind of rootless cosmopolite throughout Europe, never returned to Dublin, and yet based the most difficult, enormous, monstrous novels of the 20th century, monstrous in the very best sense, Finnegan's Wake and Ulysses, on the streets he'd walked as a boy in Dublin. And I would just respond to your question by saying, the Jews are my Irish, and Newark and Jerusalem and Prague, those cities are my Dublin. And this is what I have, I think, in many ways, been fortunate enough to have been given. And at the heart of Operation Shylock is the issue of the relationship between the Jew and the West, the relationship between the Jew and history. Written in a from historical or philosophical context, but these issues flowed through my frail frame as a kind of combatant of in this Jewish war. I don't mean the war against the Arabs. I mean the war within the Jewish soul. So that's my long answer to your brief question.
What is the war within the Jewish soul?
Well, in the book, for instance, we find this fellow who did indeed pretend to be me, went around Jerusalem selling a doctrine he called diasporism, which is that he wanted to do is get the Jews out of Israel. He's a kind of anti-Moses, taking the Jews out of Israel back to Europe, where he says they can avert the Holocaust, which will befall them in the Middle East. And that his point was that Jews don't belong in this state. The state is only endangering them further. Jews belong in the world. The Zionist argument is just the opposite, which is you Jews are crazy to live in the world. You are endangered in the world. And you must come and live here. What's at the core of this conflict is danger. And what's at the core of that danger is anti-Semitism. And what I think I wrote in Operation Shylock is a book about my adventures, not at the heart of darkness, but at the heart of the Jewish obsession with anti-Semitism.
I can't tell whether you're speaking in persona or in fact when you say that when you're in Israel, you met somebody who used your name, pretended mm-hmm. they were you, and promoted this theory mm-hmm. of diasporism.
Let's pursue this, okay? I understand your skepticism. It's not the first. You're not the first skeptical reader who's a skeptical and intelligent reader, by the way, who's confronted this book and said to me, "Oh, come on, this is a novel," and this is not an illegitimate reading. It happens to be a wrong reading, but it's not illegitimate, and I can see I can see all the things that it arises from, but it just ain't so. Preposterous things happen to everyone. Unlikely things happen to everyone. I think that in our world, rather unlikely things often happen to writers. This fellow, who bore a very strong resemblance to me, and as we all know, there are many people in the world who look like us, decided to go off on a lark or a scam or something. I have not penetrated what he was up to, but did indeed go off to Israel with his lady friend and announced that I had arrived there. And the attempt was to exploit my reputation for whatever it may be for his own benefit, crazy benefit. This led to further adventures, and anybody who's been involved with an intelligence service would not be skeptical, I believe, about what then ensued. And I got involved with an intelligence service peripherally and then did something for them. So that's what happened. Now, the fact that nobody wants to believe this is mightily amusing to me. For any number of personal reasons, it does not seriously disturb my composure because I know what happened. But it's amusing because for years I've been told about the books I write, beginning with Portnoy's Complaint, oh, he just writes about himself. They're only about himself. He can't make anything up. That's his story. And I live with this and said, ladies and gentlemen, these are acts of imagination, whether you believe it or not. And what fell the a hero of Portnoy's Complaint or his sexual prowess, unfortunately, is not my own. Or what befell the heroes of Zuckerman, the hero of the Zuckerman books, though drawn very often from biographical facts of my own, that the entire adventure taken together was not my adventure, and they insisted that it was. Now, I've written a book, to conclude, in which I say, ladies and gentlemen, this all happened to me. It's as you say, I can't make anything up. And all I meet with is resistance of those who say, oh, but you made all this up. So there's an ironic side to it, but that will pass, I think.
I'm going to briefly change the subject.
Mm.
I want to go back to Portnoy for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if Portnoy's complaint is a disorder in which strongly felt ethical and altruistic impulses are perpetually warring with extreme sexual longings, often of a perverse nature, then, I don't want to make the assumption that, you know, Portnoy was you or that you felt what he felt or whatever. But I think for most people when they're younger, there is a kind of greater sexual urge that is often at odds with other urges. And then you get older and that cools off a little bit.
Don't be so sure.
Don't be so sure. Okay. Well, my question is or was going to be, do you feel that you went through a stage in your life where the kind of sexual distraction cooled off, and if so, what else? What took its place? How did it affect you as a writer? Well, here we go.
Well, you ask a question I have to think about. A question full of assumptions.
Yes,
that
I'm first to admit it.
That I'm afraid I have to surgically dismember. Where do you get this idea that sexual desire cools off? What have you been reading?
What can I tell you?
I think that Portnoy's complaint was very much about a man of that age. And in that way, I don't mean to challenge what you're saying. I think it's true. It may well be that not only a different man, but a man of another age might be able to more cunningly negotiate the contradiction, seeming contradiction. And it might be that there's a certain amount of naivete, youthful naivete, though Portnoy's a man in his 30s, nonetheless, there might be a certain amount of youthful naivete in someone who even experiences this as a conflict and doesn't negotiate it more cunningly. It may be generational, too. It may have been that those of Portnoy's generation were ill-equipped because of X, Y, and Z factors to do anything but bang their heads against the extreme nature of the longings, the perverse nature of the longings, and their purported ethical mission. As for us old guys, I think that's another program.
Right. Okay. That's fine. Philip Roth, his new novel is called Operation Shylock, A Confession. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a look into the faiths, practices, structure, and meanings of gay life in America. We talk to Frank Browning, author of The Culture of Desire. Browning's new book is based on his experiences as a gay man and as a journalist. Previously, Browning reported on the AIDS crisis for NPR. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Wandering Spirit, the latest solo album by Mick Jagger. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A federal judge has ruled that a White House task force on health care reform may not continue its secret meetings. NPR's Patricia Naimond reports.
President Clinton formed the task force 5 days after taking office and named his wife, Hillary Rodham Clinton, to head it. Since marshaling 400 or so experts into service, the task force has been meeting behind closed doors in the West Wing of the White House. Last month, three groups, two healthcare organizations and a public interest group, filed suit, charging the task force was violating a 1972 law, one of the so-called Sunshine Laws, which aims to safeguard against outside influence on the White House. Under that law, federal advisory committees must be open to the public. Today, the court said the task force must comply with that law. White House officials have said all along the private meetings ensured that the work could get done without the distraction of media attention and public debate. It's not clear yet how this court ruling will affect the task force. I'm Patricia Naimond reporting.
After 2 days of hearings on Capitol Hill, the Senate Judiciary Committee has confirmed Miami prosecutor Janet Reno as U.S. Attorney General. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The 18-0 vote came late in the afternoon at the end of 2 days of hearings in which Reno encountered practically no opposition from the Judiciary Committee members. Today, under questioning, she said she opposed a ban on handguns, argued for swift punishment of criminals, and endorsed victims' rights. Reno also made a pitch for simplifying legal language.
I want lawyers to start talking in small, old words that people can understand, and nothing I know could better help people appreciate the justice system.
Reno said her top priorities will be to fight violent crime, drug trafficking, and public corruption, and that one of her first actions will be to focus on the bombing at the World Trade Center. The full Senate is expected to vote later this week, thus ending the Clinton administration's embarrassing and time-consuming search for an attorney general. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the Capitol.
Another arrest has been made in connection with the bombing of New York's World Trade Center last month. 25-year-old Nadal Ayad has been arrested on a complaint charging him with aiding and abetting the bombing. He was taken into custody at his home in Maplewood, New Jersey. An FBI complaint alleges that the suspect shares a joint bank account with the man arrested earlier in the case and that he was involved in renting a van used in the bombing. The father of the arrested man says his son is a graduate of Rutgers, that he has a degree in chemical engineering and is employed at Allied Signal Company. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 6 points to close at a new high of 3,478.34 on volume of more than 255 million shares. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. In Moscow, supporters of Russian President Boris Yeltsin have defeated an impeachment effort in parliament, but hardline opponents have accused Yeltsin of pulling the nation's armed forces into the controversy, at the same time turned down his efforts to share power. Pro-communist forces appear to be ready to take away more powers from the president and curtail his efforts at economic reforms. Most parliament members were elected before the collapse of the former Soviet Union, and many are strongly opposed to moves to a free market economy, which has caused high inflation and lower industrial production. Supporters of Yeltsin blame easy credit policies of the Russian parliament control central bank for new problems. On Capitol Hill, the budget committees of the House and Senate have been meeting and are pushing through the president's economic package. Majority Democrats on the House panel have defeated a Republican alternative. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Democrats on the House Budget Committee defeated the Republican plan on a near party-line vote, and later this evening are expected to approve their own proposal that contains $63 billion more in cuts than the original Clinton plan. Republicans charged the plan lacks specifics, resulting in this exchange between Budget Committee Chairman Martin Szabo of Minnesota and Republican Jim Colby of Arizona.
What are these real spending cuts that you're talking about, Mr. Chairman?
They are real spending cuts.
Where are they?
They're reflected in the total dollars.
What are they?
They will stay within the caps of 94, of 95, and of 96, and 97, and 98.
Meanwhile, the Senate Budget Committee has begun considering a plan that would cut $96 billion from the Clinton proposal. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Officials in Egypt say police and Muslim extremists have engaged in a series of clashes, and 18 people have been killed and a number of other people wounded. Among the dead are three policemen and the wife and baby of a militant. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Frank Browning is a journalist who is gay. On the job, he says, he used to keep his sexual identity neither hidden nor open. But in the late 80s, while reporting from San Francisco on the AIDS epidemic for NPR, he became more involved with the gay subculture. He started wondering, is there a gay culture comparable to other ethnic and racial cultures? He explores that question in his new book, The Culture of Desire, Paradox and Perversity in Gay Lives Today. Browning is a former full-time reporter for NPR. You may have also heard him guest host Fresh Air a few years back. He now divides his time between San Francisco and Kentucky, where his family has an apple orchard. He used to be skeptical that gay men could fabricate their own culture. What does he think now?
I think there is a dream of a gay culture. And that culture, yeah, I think there is something like it. I'm still uncomfortable with whether it exists, but there's something out there that has cohered now in public for a quarter of a century that has connections to something that was very subterranean for at least a century before that. And so I do see, you know, the post-Stonewall macho clone generation passing on certain ways of being, certain ways of behaving to the younger queer men and women who are trying to figure out a civil rights agenda, figure out a sexual agenda, figure out a male-female agenda. I see a sense of passing on. Where it's going to lead, whether it's going to mean that the West Village and the East Village in New York and the Castro district in San Francisco and West Hollywood, whether it's going to mean that all those places persist for 500 years as the meccas of gay culture, well, I don't know. I kind of doubt that. But I think there is this kind of collective self-reflection that has begun over the last quarter century to take place that tell us, yes, there are cultural continuities between those of us who think of ourselves as queer. And what's most exciting is a lot of the time it's begun to draw in a fair number of straight people who are not so sure they're straight anymore and begin to think of queer as an exciting thing.
Frank, let me ask you, do you think you can recognize people who are gay? Can you tell?
In America, pretty much.
How?
No, but let me say what I mean.
Uh-huh.
Gay is, for the most part, a white, middle-class, male construction. There are a lot of men who have sex with each other who don't fit that category, and a lot of them are very uncomfortable with the idea of gay. So,
but because by gay you're implying a whole lifestyle that goes along with it?
Yeah, it...
A whole set of cultural attitudes?
Certain set of attitudes, a certain set of books that you've read. It's a certain sort of litmus test of if you will, gay cultural literacy, right? And so when I go to Brazil, I mean, at times I wonder if there's anybody who's straight there. That's what an anthropologist once told me about Brazil as well, because the notion of sexual identity is so fluid. How do I notice it here? It's a certain sense of irony about how you conduct yourself. And we're talking about men here. I mean, it's as though, yeah, I look like a man. I can walk down the street just like you do. But, hey, what, you know, there's something else going on here. And so you're sort of seeing yourself with an extra eye in as you walk down. And you pretend, you sort of have all the trappings of a conventional of a conventional guy who's trained to sort of get his own way and run the world, and yet there is this irony which leads to what Susan Sontag a long time ago called camp. That way of knowing that fate gave you a double deck, and you're both a male in a conventional way, and you're not one. And you're always playing at the theater of who you are, and that shows up. At the simplest level, when you're horny, you look at each other in the eye the way straight men never do, and you say, mm-hmm.
In your book, you write that the examination of gayness might tell us as much about the portion of America that isn't gay as it does about the portion that is. What do you think you learned about the portion of America that isn't gay by investigating the portion that is gay?
You learn about fear. Several years ago, a close friend and I were serving on... We were serving on the board of the National Writers Union. We were having this conversation. And I said, John, do you think that we're wired different neurologically? Or do you think it's learned? And this is a very open, straight man. And he said, well, no, I think it is culture. I think we are, in all the ways that Freud and others describe, trained to suppress certain of our sensual experiences. And the question I always want to ask is, oh dear, why? Why at this point, when all of the structures of behavior and family tradition and all those things we've inherited about how it is to behave are in such flux, why would one be so fearful? That's the issue in the military question. The question, I mean, nobody, isn't it interesting right now on this whole military question? All the reporting is, or nearly all of it, doesn't seem to be about what are those awful homosexuals doing. It's, what's going to happen to our poor straight boys? You know, can they handle it? Can they take it? Can they take having a guy look at them? Will they go bananas and start shooting, or will they simply wilt under that, you know, that dreadful stare of this superhuman homosexual who's going to ravage a whole barracks, you know? I mean, it's fascinating to me, you know. We're the tigers, and the straights are the poofs. I mean, isn't this bizarre? I mean, roll the film back 10 years ago. What are they afraid of? And that's part of what I say. That's part of what is interesting to me. Other things that are interesting to me about what we learn about straight people, so-called, if there are, I guess there are a few people who are absolutely genetically straight, is how we handle tenderness and how we handle intimacy, how we handle caregiving. What are we learning from the way gay men in San Francisco or Lexington or New York, what are we learning from what they have done taking care of their own, of our own, in this epidemic that may help the baby boom generation deal with getting old, you know? What happened in San Francisco in the wake of the AIDS epidemic is that it cost half as much to take care of people with AIDS as it did anywhere else in America, and that is because these extended families that were created did it. They built volunteer systems. They constructed ways for people to have a life in the face of death.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Frank Browning, and he's written a new book called The Culture of Desire, Paradox and Perversity in Gay Lives today. Frank, let's take a short break, and then we'll come back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Frank Browning. In the late 80s, he reported on the AIDS epidemic for NPR. When you were an AIDS reporter, was it the first time that you were reporting on a story that you were really close to, people who you knew or you might have known, as opposed to like an issue that you were pretty far away from?
No, it was the closest I've ever been to a story that mattered deeply to me. But you know, journalism for me has always been a technique of finding out what I care about. Journalism is a way to ask questions that you maybe are afraid to ask if you didn't have the excuse of the microphone and the notepad. It's a way of behaving in the world and making sense of things. I mean, the last book I wrote was about crime. I wanted to understand deviance and crime in America, and the way I figured it out was to write a book about it.
You know, what you're saying reminds me of something. I've often said that I can ask anything to anyone if it's in the professional context of an interview, and that I'd ask things of strangers in an interview sooner than I'd ask them of friends. And something I found is that sometimes if I'm interviewing someone who has AIDS, I really will ask anything with their permission. But with a friend who has AIDS, I'm much more kind of careful about assessing their mood, what they feel like talking about. Do you know what I mean? What do I want to talk about this more? Do they not want to? Do you know what I'm saying? I find I'm more forward with the microphone, even when it comes to illness.
Sure. A microphone is a license to invade. A microphone is a license to not only to invade, but to take that story and make it your own. That's what we're paid to do. That's what our obligation is to do. But that's not what we do with the people we love. And every now and then I found myself in a very personal conversation, and the other person will say, you're interviewing me. And I pull back and I say, oh, I am, aren't I? Because there is something. There's something nasty about journalism. And that nastiness is that you feel as though you have the peremptory right to invade the finest, most obscure intimacy and turn it into your trade, or if you're good, into your art. I think painters do the same thing. I mean, this is what Janet Malcolm said about all writing, isn't it? I mean, writers are traitors. You know, we come in, we tell you we're going to repeat your story, but we don't. We come in, we get the details of your story, and we use it to explain our own stories.
When you were reporting on AIDS, you had to use a completely different kind of language than when you were reporting on issues. I mean, other issues, you know, more political issues rather than issues of health and the body and of the sexual transmission of the virus. What kinds of dilemmas did you face about the kind of language to use when you were talking about sex and AIDS?
Well, they're the obvious ones, like, you know, what are the rules? Can you talk about anal intercourse this week or not? And that's changed at NPR from time to time, just as it did at the Washington Post and the New York Times. Those are kind of, what do they call it in the networks, standards and procedures or something like that. The more difficult one is, how much do you tell? You know, if you know something special, how much do you tell? How much do you dare to try to explain the complex relationship to sexuality and intimacy that has developed in the last 25 years of gay life? Can you really get that across with muffin and coffee at 6:45 in the morning, knowing that people are trying to dress the kids? Or if you talk about it in telegraphic journalistic language, does it simply seem as though you're pandering and sensational and looking for the hot tape cut that's going to get letters? You know, everybody likes letters. Doesn't matter whether they're good letters or bad letters. You like letters. But that was difficult to me. So that led to a third level of language, and that is, how could I imply the ordinariness of gay lives without pointing it out? You know, how could I refer to someone's lover who was sitting by making coffee as sort of by the by, you know, and let people know that these were human beings going about their lives trying to survive and continue? And you know, it's funny. I went, when I was the last AIDS assignment I had at NPR as a full-time staff member, I was out at the AIDS conference in 1990, and I had my little dog tag on and my microphone in my hand, and people were out there chanting, making a ruckus, and this guy came up to me. He was from North Carolina, and he looked at me, and I guess, I was talking with a friend of mine. I may have had my arm around him or something like that, okay? And this guy from North Carolina came up to me, and he said, uh-huh, I've been listening to your reports. I thought so. I thought you were queer. And I said, how? He said, I don't know. It was just something about accepting without question the naturalness of the relations that you were talking about. Something about the language in which you didn't distance yourself. You didn't talk about gay people as those people, but simply as ordinary people.
You've subtitled your book Paradox and Perversity in Gay Lives Today. What are the paradoxes that you're thinking about?
The paradoxes... to be a guy who looks like a regular guy out there but really isn't, you know, that's one of them. To have the gall to to suppose that you can make a culture out of nothing more than longing, which is almost the antithesis of the idea of a culture. The paradox, you know, it's Oscar Wilde, I quote, who said, you know, what paradox was to me in the realm of thought, perversity was in the realm of the senses. And that we all live with enormous numbers of masks that we're continuously changing back and forth. You know, I am the reporter doing pieces for National Public Radio, and here I am the apple grower, in which I sort of slip back into my Kentucky accent a little bit, though it's not real strong. And it's not phony. It just happens when I'm there. And here I am somebody who's terribly interested in the crises of Bruno Bettelheim, and I have all these personas, and I sort through them. And I find a life, and I don't feel too schizophrenic or any more than seems healthy. I think of my sexual desires primarily homosexual, and yet I don't live in a gay ghetto. I think of this whole new generation of young queer people who don't often call themselves gay, who revel in the queerness of having sex with women, even though, I mean, even though they went there with a guy. You know, these things are linked. It's the unknowableness of it all that is what I celebrate as perversity. Perversity is fantastic. It's what makes us be alive.
You celebrate perversity?
Sure. Pray that we all be more perverse.
Why?
Because perverse is a recognition that life is a mystery. I mean, if you're not perverse, then you have no sense of irony. You think you know all the answers. You know who you are. Well, as soon as you know who you are, you're dead. There's no more living. There's no more questions. There's no more search. Huh? Thank you, no.
Frank Browning, his new book is called The Culture of Desire. This is Fresh Air. Coming up on All Things Considered, we'll hear news on Hillary Rodham Clinton's task force on health care reform. Let's get a preview from Linda Wertheimer. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. The federal judge ruled today that this task force meetings have to be open because Mrs. Clinton is not technically an employee of the federal government, and if any outsider is there, then other outsiders are permitted to be in. This, of course, is good news for lobbyists who are very interested in what's happening. Also, other big news in the LAPD trial, Rodney King is still on the stand. Renee Montaigne will do a piece for us on who's watching from the audience, and there's been another arrest in the World Trade Center bombing.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Mick Jagger has put out solo albums before, She's the Boss in 1985 and Primitive Cool in 1987. Neither of them were very well received, commercially or critically. But his new release, Wandering Spirit, is getting attention for the way it revitalizes the old Rolling Stone sound. Critic Ken Tucker has this review.
Yeah, you put me in the trash. Yeah, you gave me up for love.
Yeah, I guess I had put Mick Jagger in the trash, consigned him to the dustbin of rock history. After all, the Rolling Stones now seem a tad pathetic. Dinosaurs who stagger out of their caves every half decade or so with a new batch of songs that remind you of the old batch of songs. But the nice thing about Wandering Spirit is that Jagger more or less owns up to this. He chews over the idea of his obsolescence as a Rolling Stone and then spits it out, rejecting it. True to its title, Wandering Spirit is all over the map, very uneven in its song styles and performances. But never in his solo career has Jagger sounded so swaggeringly self-assured as he does on a terrific song like Out of Focus.
Oh, I saw a glittering dawn. Oh, I saw a beautiful morning. Shine. The future with my fingernails. But now I live in fear. It's all out of
Jagger has recorded Wandering Spirit with producer Rick Rubin, who in the past has worked primarily with young hardcore metal and rap music acts. Jagger hasn't, thank goodness, tried to do any impersonations of a rude, booty-worshipping gangster rapper. If he had, he'd have given new meaning to the term arrested development. Instead, he's used Rick Rubin to give a harder, sharper edge to the music that accompanies his squalling vocals. But I'm not saying that Rubin is the secret hero of Wandering Spirit. I think Jagger is in full control, especially when he's working in genres he's experimented with before. For example, Jagger has always had a thing for country music, going back at least as far as Wild Horses with the Stones. But he's never sung country music as convincingly as he does on Evening Gown.
People say I'm high class, but I'm low down all the while. People think that I'm crazy when I flash that California smile. But I can still paint the town all the colors of your
On the faster, louder songs here, Jagger spends a lot of time bragging. I'm hard as a brick, he yells on Wired All Night. I'm a mother of a man, he growls on a tune with the same name. For once, he's earned that boasting. The loud stuff is really good. But after Wandering Spirit drops off the charts, it may be the quiet music on this collection that lingers in our minds, that reminds us of what a satisfyingly complicated spirit Mick Jagger can be.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. I'm Terry Gross.
I wish I was in London or some other seaport town. I set myself on a steamship and I'll see the ocean round. While sailing around the ocean, while sailing around the sea, I dream of handsome Molly wherever she might be. Her hair is as black as raven, her eyes as black as coal. Her teeth are like lilies that in the morning glow. Oh, don't you remember Molly?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Waiting for the End of the World, we talk with psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton about his study of cult groups and fundamentalist religions that are preparing for the apocalypse. Also, options for healthcare reform, we'll talk with Harvard professor Mark Roberts. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.